Portland.
Cable Community Radio is supported by our members and by the Columbia SLU Watershed Council's SLU DIY House Party, An Excuse to Let Loose, an online benefit on Friday, April 23rd, with live music from The Wren, the Matisse's Latin Ensemble, and DJ Dr. Mom. Tickets and more information can be found at columbiaslu.org.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Welcome to Labor Radio. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilland.
Thank you so much for tuning in and joining us. Quickly, just before we get into our show today, we'd like to give a special thanks and shout out to the Labor Radio Podcast Network for hosting podcasted versions of our show each month. Be sure to check that out at laborradionetwork.org. And also, for those of you listening on KBOO right now, just want to let our listeners know that KBOO's Spring Membership Drive is here, and this season we're focusing on programming that plants the seeds and defends the roots. Now more than ever, volunteer-run, community-powered radio is a vitally important resource providing much-needed information, entertainment, and a sense of connection to us all during this time of uncertainty and isolation. So if you can, please show your support and help us grow KBOO's grassroots membership base by going to kboo.org/give. And speaking of planting seeds and defending the roots, we're going to turn now to the effort to organize a union, the first ever union in an Amazon facility in this country, that just took place in Bessemer, Alabama. If you have paid attention to the news or if you listened to this show in recent weeks and months, I'm sure you've probably heard about the effort down there. It was a historic effort to basically form the first ever union at an Amazon facility in this country. Now, unfortunately, the effort lost by the vote lost by a margin of more than 2-1. But although it did lose, this is basically just the first battle in what is sure to be a long effort to organize unions at different facilities for Amazon workers around the country. The Bessemer Drive, it was always going to be an uphill battle. That was known from the start, and that is in fact why it took so long for a union to actually want to support an effort to organize at Amazon in the first place, because Amazon is one of the wealthiest companies in the entire history of the world, and they have a massive workforce. They have huge political pull in both the local city and state governments where they operate, but also with our federal government. And so it was always a long shot and an uphill battle, but it was a valiant battle. And what it despite the fact that it did not win the actual vote to unionize the workers, it did win the hearts and minds of working people around the country, and it raised, the sights and the imagination of what is possible with organizing for workers in all sectors of our economy. There was a lot of things that were stacked against the folks organizing down there, not the least of which was the size of the bargaining unit that was basically forced by the NLRB. Amazon lawyers petitioned the labor board to increase the size of the bargaining unit from what was initially petitioned by the union to be, I believe it was 1,500 workers, and they forced them to raise that all the way up to like 5,000 workers, the entire facility, which, of course, just created more work and a longer shot for the union to actually get the vote it needed. Another key factor, that was always going to be stacked against them was the high turnover rate that made it hard to determine who all the eligible workers were at the facility. It was estimated by organizers with the union that there is a 100% turnover rate from year to year at that specific facility, which indicates that there are more employees that leave or are fired per year than the average number of people working at the warehouse. Another big factor stacked against them was the fact that the job was considered a good one by local standards, which means that folks who may have been on the fence or may have not been particularly revved up about the union may not have wanted to rock the boat, and therefore, they recognized they had a good, secure job that paid well, and they didn't want to mess that up by, pissing the bosses off or, potentially risking getting fired or any other things that come with basically trying to organize a union in an ununionized workplace. On top of that, this took place in Alabama. Like, there is no avoiding the fact that it took place in a notoriously anti-union southern state that is one of the main right-to-work states in this country, and that it has an entirely, you know, from top to bottom, a political leadership that is hostile to, you know, the agenda of unions and of working people in general. You know, and then, of course, on top of that, again, it is in the American South, and so this was a union effort undertaken by primarily a black workforce, and it took place in a virulently racist state, and I think that, you know, played pretty heavily into the fact that there was not a lot of local support from politicians in Alabama for this effort. And then, you know, on top of that, again, the resources that Amazon could deploy against the organizing workers, you know, that included so many things like hiring union busting consultants, which they did, coordinating with the local government to do things, you know, to thwart the organizers, which we'll get into in a little bit here. And of course, you know, Bezos and the Amazon executives having large media platforms at their disposal to spin misinformation about this effort. And of course, there's the fact that, you know, Amazon is a extremely tough, union-free workplace. You know, they have worked really hard to keep unions out of, you know, their facilities in all levels, including, you know, in the executive or, you know, the administrative offices in Seattle and soon to be in the D.C. area. And, you know, of course, also with their drivers and in their facilities, you know, their sorting facilities and their warehouses and things like that. So this was an attempt to basically create the first crack in a very strong shield against unionizing workforces at Amazon. So even with all of that stacked against them, and with victory so unlikely, it was still a worthwhile fight for the workers to undertake. It, you know, among other things, it caught the public's attention and reinvigorated working people's imagination for what is possible. It helped show union establishment and union leaders that the value of undertaking efforts deemed, you know, quote, unwinnable by conventional thinking, and, you know, the media attention, the public attention that can raise. And most importantly, it sparked other Amazon workers to begin trying to unionize their workplaces. So, you know, obviously this is a big defeat, and, you know, it's a very public defeat. But I think that, as we mentioned, like, the seeds that were planted here will be, you know, defended and allowed to grow in other parts of our economy, whether that be at Amazon workplaces in particular, or at other, you know, similar types of facilities, or just, you know, within the working class in general. I think this was a great opening salvo in the long fight that is yet to come against, you know, to regain ground for the labor movement in this country. And so, yeah, this is just the first fight, first in a long fight. And that is, you know, that was, I think, something that was understood by the workers there, as well as the union that undertook it, mm-hmm. and everyone who came out in support of it, including, you know, celebrities and politicians, and, you know, people like our President Joe Biden, who mentioned, you know, actually came out and gave a video message to the workers, not specifically mentioning Amazon, but definitely making clear that he is in favor of and supports workers' right to organize, and that there should be nothing that impedes that, which is a great, you know, message, something that you haven't necessarily heard from a lot of presidents in our lifetime, and it definitely sets the tone, and I think leads sets the tone for the Biden administration, and also shows working people and labor movement that they have a friend in the White House. And of course, we will get into this a little bit more as we move forward through the show, but, you know, kudos where props to Biden for that.
Yeah, and I think it's really difficult in these situations as well, mostly because of the turnover.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. You know, I think the individuals who were a part of this are probably learned a lot from the experience. I know I read several articles from both sides of it, you know, other people saying it felt like a, you know, a punch in the gut.
Yeah.
And then others kind of saying, you know, I'm kind of glad it's over so I can, you know, stop being so stressed out about it. And you know, while I think it probably wasn't the right choice, you know, I can understand if you're not used to this type of thinking or behavior or just ongoing political kind of communication, it can be a little bit overwhelming.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I hope at least the people who are a part of it kind of take away, you know, and the next kind of maybe gig opportunity they're at, they kind of evaluate the working conditions and things like that.
Yeah.
That really comes back to my, you know, point of saying it's difficult when the turnover is so large, because the group of workers isn't going to look back and say, hey, you know, we questioned our working environment and then things got worse because we didn't unionize. you know, there's just no shared memory there.
Right.
So, you know, we've talked about all the ways that the gig economy can make these things more difficult. And, you know, just a non, you know, kind of like kind of consistent group of workers in a single place, you know, like I said, there's just no environment for them to kind of recall different events or kind of point to mistreatment in the past. You really experience, each group is experiencing it for the first time.
Exactly. Like there's no, like you said, there's no long-term history or memory there for the workforce because the turnover is so rapid that it's like, you know, there's no knowledge that carries on.
Yeah, so you really hope they just kind of continue on and kind of recognize, hey, you know, here's the environment I had, it gets worse. And obviously, you know, you mentioned it, it was in a state where I think unionization has struggled in the South. So
But that, I mean, that really does bring up a good point, which I think is, you know, not only will this maybe inspire those workers that are currently working there, but it definitely, it shifted the narrative or created a narrative for working people in general to recognize that even though they as individuals at this facility or at that facility may not have a long-term knowledge of, you know, well, we've all experienced these issues at the workplace and it's now long past time for us to create a union. You know, that specific history may not exist for those workers in that workplace, but it has been built, the narrative has been built within the working class now that, like, this is something that is correct. Like, these workers do deserve to have a collective bargaining unit inside such a strong company. And that hopefully will just sort of disseminate to workers everywhere, regardless of whether or not they were involved in this or not. You know, like, even if you are a new hire at an Amazon facility, you are now aware of the fact that workers at other Amazon facilities have attempted to do this and have thought it was a valid move, and therefore you can carry that into your workplace even though it may not have already happened there and it may not be a topic of discussion within that workplace. People coming in, new hires, will bring that with them. And so that is now just pervasive within the working class and within our culture in general, you know, more broadly. Like, this was a huge media moment, which, you know, for better or worse, the media only focuses on stories that either they see an angle on or that they recognize are unavoidable. And so the fact that this became something that was covered not only in, like, you know, pro-labor, like, left-wing press, but also by, like, CNN and MSNBC and the New York Times. I mean, the fact that it became a major story on mainstream media says something about the fact that, like, this is a concept that exists and is growing within our culture, that we need to strengthen unions. And potentially one of the big issues with our growing inequality in this country is the fact that union density has declined precipitously over the last 40 plus years. And so I think that's a conversation that's finally being restarted.
Yeah, it's changing. It's changing. Yeah. The polling numbers for unions is incredibly high. And a Gallup poll from September, actually, of last year found that 65% of Americans actually approve of unions at this point, which is much higher than it's been kind of in the last 20 or so years.
Right.
I think, you know, what we touch on is not all of that polling is going to be the same in specific states, especially when you get down to smaller groups or specific cities, right? So this was kind of a nationwide poll, and I think the coasts affect, you know, the polling just by the sheer amount of population. So, you know, a place like Alabama is going to be a little bit behind, I think, in that polling. But like you said, the narrative is shifting.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, again, you know, this was not a win on the ground in this moment, but it was a win in the larger battle, you know, for hearts and minds of working people and our culture at large in this country. And of course, you know, not only is it to win the, you know, battle and even the playing field between workers and ownership, like, it's not just going to take winning the hearts and minds, but also there are massive legal hurdles and, like, frameworks that need to be reworked. Amazon, you know, in this instance, utilize the many advantages that they have that are built into the National Labor Relations Act, basically to wage a ferocious ideological campaign against the union that was petitioning to organize this place, which was the retail, wholesale, and department store workers union. And, you know, things like, as I mentioned earlier, the union, the RWDSU, initially filed a petition with the labor board to represent just a unit of 1,500 workers who were mostly pickers and packers at that facility. But Amazon's lawyers used a pretty classic anti-union tactic and countered that with with a motion that they would against with the labor board, that the union had to in fact increase the bargaining unit to include all workers at the facility,
yeah.
Which, you know, that included with seasonal employees approximately 5,800 workers in total, which, you know, was four times the number that the union had initially petitioned for. And, you know, this move basically, you know, it's pretty clear that it diluted the support that was initially received by the 1,500 workers who signed the cards to bring the union in, because, you know, that's a lot of seasonal employees, and there was a big COVID-related hiring frenzy that had just been undertaken at that facility. So you have, you know, the workers that may have been there for months or, you know, an extended period of time who recognize the need for a union. And then when you're, you know, so there was a fervor within that group of people to bring the union in, and they wanted to be unionized. But when you had to then reach out to everyone who were like the ancillary employees there, the folks who may not have spent as much time or may have been doing it as a side project or just a part-time job, the desire to rock the boat shrunk, and yeah. it definitely, as I said, it diluted the initial support that existed, and that's...
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I mean, running a campaign against a giant company like Amazon is really expensive.
Yeah.
And when you increase the number of people involved, I mean, the price goes up, and, you know, I think not every single union or kind of a hopeful union has the backing or the dollars to actually make something like that happen.
Right.
So, you know, I definitely think... you know, there's actually rules around when there can be reruns. But even on top of that, it seems to me like there probably should be some time to kind of reflect and think about different strategies or approaches, because there's not limitless money to kind of make runs at Amazon like this. And I think,
no.
You know, larger organizations like the NLRB should probably look at where they can kind of strategically place some of those dollars to be a little bit more effective. Not that
yeah.
we would want to give up in areas like this, but just to get a foothold.
Exactly. And I mean, especially when you consider that, like, these efforts go up against, you know, not limitless money, but we're talking Amazon, which,
mm-hmm.
you know, effectively in relation to what a union has, it's essentially limitless resources at their disposal. And ample desire to prevent this, you know, a union from getting a foothold in any one of their facilities in any part of the world,
yeah.
because they are a global company, and if
yeah.
somewhere gets unionized, that then trickles to other places. You know?
And it's just easier for Amazon to stay in the news.
Yes.
If you were kind of online the last couple of weeks, you probably have seen a lot of the new rules that Amazon has put forward as well, to kind of prove that their workforce isn't robots. They put out basically a bunch of rules showing a bunch of robotic rules,
yeah.
I should say, basically showing how they aren't. You know, for example, you know, using different algorithms to shift people's work so that, you know, over an X amount of hours, they use different muscle groups with different job priorities, right?
Yeah.
So basically trying to kind of counteract a lot of the, you know, assumption of this repetitive work can lead to, you know, long-term damage and
right.
these other things, especially yeah. even on a seasonal worker, it can lead to long-term damage. So, you know, they're going to stay in the news with these kind of, you know, maybe while well-intentioned, kind of missing the point kind
yeah.
of things.
Like
that
kind of not reading
that,
the room.
Yeah, that while if not covered correctly, I think can create a narrative of, hey, you know, things are changing for the better and things like that. And that's
yeah.
not to say that, you know, something like that can't fit into some sort of, you know, portfolio of here's how we're helping workers, right? It's just kind of not solving the core issues like
yeah.
at hand in terms of the way in which they go to market just as a for-profit business
mm-hmm.
is just kind of at odds with, you know, I think a lot of the things that the labor movement is about just from a actual, like, protecting people standpoint. You know, the amount of return that someone gets because they're bringing capital to the table versus bringing their actual labor. Like, these are the things that I think are a little bit more at odds than specifically the individual muscle groups, right?
Right.
So, I think depending on how that stuff is covered, I think you can come away with it with some really differing opinions on what's actually going on the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, that's actually a really good segue. Just for folks who are just tuning in and just joining us, we're discussing the Amazon union worker, or the Amazon workers who attempted to unionize in Bessemer, Alabama, and sort of, you know, what the successes of that were, what the failures are. And actually, I'd like to turn now, as you were just mentioning, Elliot, to the tactics that were used, you know, to try and dissuade folks from supporting the union, and what it is that the the resources of a large company like Amazon are able to put towards defeating this effort. So, you know, Amazon themselves, they did a lot of things like seeking to delay the vote and convince work, you know, to get more time to convince workers not to join the union. But they did a lot more nefarious things beyond just what is, you know, technically allowed under the NLRB. They have unparalleled resources, as I imagine, which, you know, seem limitless in comparison to what the union was able to put forward. And so they did something like, and we've mentioned this before on the show, but they hired a union busing specialist named Russell Brown, who's part of RWP Labor, which is a Koch brother backed union busing consultancy. So they hired that group to basically form the campaign that would go be used against the workers and be used to sort of spread the anti-union fervor or sentiment within the workforce. They did things like send mass text messages to workers warning them not to vote yes, and they sometimes sent up to 5 a day, which, you know, if you've ever received, you know, those corporate, if you've ever received a text message from your boss or from your employer, mm-hmm. It's not a good sign if you're getting 5 a day unless your job is specifically texting them back and forth. You know, they also did things like set up an anti-union website, which they encouraged workers to visit, and had signs posted all around the facility encouraging folks to go and take a look at that, to learn the truth about what unionizing means. You know, they have a lot of, like, obfuscating language that goes into that, trying to just be like, hey, we're just trying to give you the facts and things like that, when really it's just straight-up anti-union propaganda. You know, and on top of that, they sponsored Facebook ads that were targeted at the workers, encouraging them to vote no. Because, again, Amazon has massive financial resources at their disposal. They could just pummel these workers with ads on their social media. They also, as I mentioned, posted a bunch of signs within the like, just papered the facility, including the bathroom stalls with signage asking them to vote no, encouraging them to vote no. Which, you know, obviously that may not be the most direct way, or it may not be the most effective way, but if you are someone who's on the fence and you're walking through your facility or you're using the facilities and you are being just constantly bombarded with your boss telling you this is bad, it will likely sway you if you are on the fence.
Well, especially if you don't really fully grasp what a union's right. going to do for you, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned at the top of the show that a lot of these people, in comparison to a lot of the job offerings that are available in the Bessemer area, it's in the top half of jobs, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So if you believe yourself to be in the top half of kind of the quality jobs that are available to you, and you don't quite understand what a union can do for you, then, you know, a fear tactic can be pretty effective in saying, hey, why rock the boat for me, you know, yeah. as an individual? You know, I'm in here until the end of summer, or till the end of, like, if it's Amazon month or day, I forget what they do where they have promo. Like, say you're in for a couple weeks and now you've been included in this, in the group that needs to vote on this. It can be a pretty, scary thing, and voting no seems a lot easier than voting yes.
Exactly, because, I mean, again, voting no is maintaining the status quo, which if you're someone who is fearful of losing your job or is uncertain about the result of that vote, maintaining the status quo seems a lot better than an unknown, you know, a future unknown. And, you know, so if being instilling fear in the workers was not the way to go, they also did things like provide offering cash incentives to encourage, you know, quote unquote, unhappy workers to just quit. So, you know, here we'll give you a generous severance package, you know, generous being in quotes. But if you're talking about, you know, being unhappy with the conditions here, here's some money, get out of here. Like, you're mm-hmm. done, leave the workplace. Instead of being there to help your fellow coworkers in solidarity and fight for a union, just take the money and run.
Yeah.
And, you know, they, of course, also did things like enroll workers into Amazon-sponsored classes with instructors who attempted to scare workers about the dangers of joining a union. And that, of course, included false claims like that unionization may decrease wages, which is a pretty common bit of misinformation in workplaces. I remember Delta did the same thing when they were encouraging their workers not to unionize as well. And, you know, they're not the only ones. Probably every workplace that has encouraged their workers not to form a union has talked about how it may decrease wages, which, you know, it may, but it likely won't, because when you collectively bargain, you are going to present a stronger position, and therefore you will argue for higher wages. That's one of the main things that people do argue for when forming unions. And, you know, so those are all the things that they did within the facility. There's a bunch of things that they did that are even more questionable that took place outside, that required sort of the Amazon to work in collusion with government entities to help squash this effort, including doing something which seems, you know, at first it seems a little questionable or a little bit, you know, like how does this really impact folks? But they worked with the city government to change the traffic lights near the facility in order to frustrate the organizers. So, you know, they basically asked the folks who run the traffic lights to increase the green times at the traffic lights around the facility, so that folks who were coming and going, you know, workers who were leaving their shift or arriving for their shift, didn't have the ability to be waiting at a traffic light and talk to the organizers who were standing outside on the sidewalk. Or, you know, that also, of course, kept them from those arriving or departing workers from being exposed to the pro-union signage that was out there. So, you know, you wouldn't be able to talk to an organizer, or you wouldn't be able to read those signs, which, you know, may seem like a small thing, but this is, you have to keep in mind, this is all taking place during this pandemic, where normally you would be doing door-to-door canvassing. The organizers would be going door-to-door, talking to these workers, mm-hmm. and explaining to them, you know, why they need a union and what the benefits are. But with COVID, that became a lot more difficult, and so the attempt was really focused on doing social media push and catching foot workers at the facility as they were coming and going. Mm-hmm. So by extending the green lights, the time for that, that meant there was less time for workers to be there as they were coming or going, talking to the organizers that were looking to catch them. They, of course, you know, they also talked to the United States Postal Service, asking them to install a mailbox at the facility, at the Amazon facility in early February, because initially they had petitioned the labor board to have the ballot drop box, you know, for folks putting their ballots in, have that be at the facility. That was denied by the labor board, but then they went to the postal service and had them put a mailbox there.
Yeah.
Which just sort of led, as the union explained, it basically, the presence of that post office box at the facility intimidated workers by suggesting that the company was involved in the collection and tallying of votes. Which, so, you know, again, it wasn't directly nefarious, but it just instilled fear in the workers, trying to intimidate them away from voting for it.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, all of these things, I think, combine to the disconnect that is appearing, where
right.
2/3 of Americans are pro-union, right? Mm-hmm. But there's this disconnect where, in the South in particular, but everywhere, a lot of unions are losing right now, whether that's COVID, all of these different tactics. I think, you know, this is really important to talk about. But as we wrap up the show and kind of talk about what's next, and, you know, what we think the labor unions and, you know, America at large need to do, I think the thing that, you know, is really important to target is a lot of the law and kind of reform. So, you know, even if in the case of Bessemer, you know, everyone was able to communicate properly, none of these tactics occurred, and there was a positive, you know, approval vote for the union, it can take years sometimes to actually get a contract created with your organizer, with your actual employer, because they can avoid it or push things off or do different things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, basically since Carter, you know, the Democratic Party has been trying to pass, you know, really big, substantial, you know, pro-union kind of actual, you know, law and reform.
Right.
And so, you know, we've talked about it a bunch on this show, but, you know, the PRO Act is kind of the gateway to helping these unions in different scenarios actually see some sort of success. Because, you know, like I mentioned, even if they had voted in the affirmative, it might not have led to anything for quite some time.
Right. It could have taken years for that contract to be negotiated.
Yeah. So it's really important to, you know, we've talked about it on the show. You know, you can obviously go to laborradio.org and listen to those, or kind of do some research on your own and kind of make sure that you're aware, and your senator's aware, and your congressman or congresswoman are aware that, you know, this is a really important piece of legislation that needs to be talked about more.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is priority number one for the labor movement, for unions, for working people in general, and it should be for the Democratic Party right now, is to pass the PRO Act. I mean, there are definitely steps that need to be taken after that, which we will get into in next month's episode. But, you know, right now, passing the PRO Act and reshaping it, we are basically in a moment where labor law has been hammered into place by, you know, employers and by business owners and the Chamber of Commerce and things like that for the last 40 years. And so it is shaped to fit their needs away from the needs of working people. So the passing the PRO Act is going to be the first step in kind of reshaping those laws and having creating a more even playing field for working people to, in fact, assert their needs and their demands and their rights and, you know, the right to collectively bargain, which is what is laid out in the NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act. It is the stated purpose of our government because of that act to